Human beings are relatively young. I mean, sure, some of us individually feel a little creaky when we wake up in the morning, but when you compare humans to some other species that walked the planet in eons past, we're sort of the new kids on the block. And the development of human beings into human beings and all that's happened since is a fascinating story. Just think of all the forces that shaped us, disasters and plagues and all the things that humans wrought upon each other. All those things are considered from a genetic point of view, and Adam Rutherford's book, A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, The Human Story Retold Through Our Genes. Adam Rutherford not only covers genetics, he studied it right up to a PhD. He writes about and delivers radio programs on science, serving as host for the BBC Radio 4 series Inside Science. Adam also frequently writes for The Guardian newspaper and website in the UK, among other outlets. Thanks for joining us, Adam Rutherford.
Hi, Jeff. It's my pleasure.
So just between you getting a PhD and now, has the science of genetics advanced even further?
Unbelievably so. I mean, it's a field that is going at such pace that, well, what I did for 3 or 4 years during my PhD, a high school student could do most of that now in about, 2 months if they were good, maybe a year if they were really slow.
Wow, that's a big change then.
It is. And it's in terms of this story, many of the sort of books about the history of our species and human evolution are just way out of date now. It's all due to the fact that we've just got better at reading genetic code and understanding it. But also we've got much, much better really in the last 5 or 6 years at taking DNA out of the bones of people who've been dead for years or centuries or even hundreds of thousands of years, and using their genetic code, their genomes, to try and re-understand, recalibrate and verify or challenge the other ways that we have of knowing the past, anthropology, paleoanthropology, and just straight history. So in that sense, yeah, genetics is also the new kid on the block.
So what would you say that some of these DNA tests on older material have yielded in terms of reconsiderations of things we once took as gospel?
Well, when I was growing up, I was always interested in human evolution. So I did genetics, but genetics and human evolution and evolution in general are very closely linked. We had very sort of well-drawn evolutionary trees for humans. So we had nice, neat branching patterns on these trees, which showed that, of the few human species from the past that we knew of, we could trace a sort of nice, neat line between organisms like Australopithecus afarensis, the most famous one is Lucy, found in the Rift Valley in Africa, dating from about 3 million years ago. And we sort of drew these patterns up through evolutionary history that ended up with us. And I talk about this in the first chapter of the book. There's the very famous image, which is known as the March of Progress, which is that image of like monkey-like character on the left, and it becomes more upright and more sturdy and taller as it progresses through time, and then eventually is a upright bearded white guy with a spear. And I kind of hate this image because it's so misrepresentative of two things. One is it says that there's a direction to our evolution, that we are destined to be technological, upright, white-skinned, and that's just not true. Evolution doesn't work like that. There is no direction to evolution. It's just about exploiting the environment that you're most suited for at that time. But the second thing is that it suggests that we know the route by which we evolved from earlier primates and earlier monkeys, and now we just don't. I mean, the more species we've discovered, the more bones we've dug out of the ground, the more genetics we've got out of some of those bones, the fuzzier the picture of our own evolution has become.
So you say that you resist the term family tree in your first paragraph. I mean, and you got into this a second ago, but I mean, it's a lot more complicated than a tree, isn't it?
It is. Trees are really useful metaphors in biology, as long as they work, which I realize is a sort of, slightly perverse thing to say so early in the morning. But evolutionary trees work broadly in that, they show the sort of broad trajectory of life on Earth from 4 billion years ago up to the present. The trouble is, when you look very closely at species like at the genus Homo, so the genus that Homo sapiens, that's us, sits within, there have been several other species of within that genus, it's just much more complicated and much more messy. So, for example, one of the things that genetics has revealed looking at the DNA, the genomes of ancient other human species, the Neanderthals, so Homo neanderthalensis. Now, the genome of the first Neanderthal was sequenced in 2009, taken from bones that were, died tens of thousands of years ago in Europe. And what it unequivocally showed is that our ancestors, Homo sapiens ancestors, successfully interbred with Neanderthals. And this happened on multiple occasions over several thousand years. And if you've got pale skin, if you are broadly of European descent today, then you carry Neanderthal DNA in your genome. So it sort of settled a big question in human evolution that has been running since Neanderthals were first discovered at the beginning of the 19th century, which is, well, did we interact with them, euphemistically? Did we have sex with them? And the answer is an unequivocal yes. There are stories like that which are just beginning to emerge, which both, they make the science more clear, but the overall picture becomes more complicated, and I think more interesting.
There is a lot of interesting stuff in the book. It is called A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, The Human Story Retold Through Our Genes, in which Adam Rutherford makes use of the vast advances in the science of genetics, and will distinguish genetics from genomics, among other tasks, when we come back to this discussion on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us by phone or email. We'll tell you how when we come back from a break. This is the Jefferson Exchange. We'll be back with Adam Rutherford and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Adam Rutherford, a British science writer and geneticist himself. He has taken note of the ways in which our knowledge of genetics and genomics has advanced greatly in recent years, in reconsidering what we think about the human race now after a few years of advances. His book is called A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, The Human Story Retold Through Our Genes. You can join us on the exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Adam, you write that geneticists have suddenly become historians. How and why?
Yeah, so it is that. It's the same thing we were talking about a minute ago, this sudden ability that has fallen into the lap of geneticists, which is to get DNA out of bones from the long dead. That if we think about the genome as a sort of logbook of all of our ancestors who have passed on their genes to us, then our ability to read our genomes, read all of our DNA, but also to read the DNA of people who've been long dead, means that we've got this new historical source, a new text that we can use to compare to the other ways that we have of knowing the past, the more traditional means like digging up old bones or archaeology, cultural remains, or indeed, documents, at least for the last few thousand years. So it's a historical text that sits alongside those. It's not better or worse. It's qualitatively different in some respects. But, you got to be, as a geneticist, I think you have to show some humility towards history and historians who a much longer established academic field of study. But for the most part, all of my interactions with historians, I spent a lot of time talking and working with historians in the last few years. They've been very positive, and they're very excited about having this new sort of scientific historical text that we together can look at and check and verify and question some of the stories that we have from traditional history.
Now, over the course of that history, and of course this book that tracks it, we're going to wander a bit between genetics and genomics. Can you explain the difference for us?
Sure. I mean, there isn't necessarily an important difference. It's more to do with the way that genetics has changed in the last few years. that genetics really is the study of genes, which are the sort of functional elements within our DNA. So genes encode proteins, and proteins are the things that make lives. So everything in a body is either made of a protein or made by a protein. So for a long time, we really focused on what genes themselves were doing. But then come the turn of this century in the Human Genome Project, which most of your listeners will have heard of, lots of it done down in California, there were a couple of revelations within this, which were we didn't appear to have enough genes to reflect the sophistication and the complexity that we like to think of ourselves as being. So, for example, we don't have as many genes as rice or bananas or water fleas or tapeworms. And so, you know, this was a bit of a surprise because it meant that we couldn't really explain our own sophistication just looking at genes. The other thing is that the Human Genome Project, we have about 3 billion letters of genetic code spread over our 23 pairs of chromosomes. Almost none of it is genes. Less than 3% of our total genome is made of genes. Now, a lot of the rest of it is sort of structural stuff, so the scaffolding to help cells as they reproduce and divide. Lots of it is sort of bits that turn genes on and off, because you don't want all genes on at all times, or else we'll be a sort of terrible blob of a creature. They've got to be turned on and off in a sort of very carefully choreographed dance. And then bits of it are just huge chunks of repeating DNA. We don't know what they do necessarily, but they're important. You know, some diseases are in those repeating chunks of text. And so we talk about genomics more than genetics more broadly now, because it's clear that the way characteristics are passed down through families and through evolutionary history is not simply just to do with the genes. It is to do with the whole of our genetic information, which is contained within the genome.
Adam Rutherford, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, The Human Story Retold Through Our Genes. You write, Adam, that we are culturally programmed to misunderstand human genetics. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's a slightly provocative statement. I do think it's correct, though. One of the reasons I wrote this book at this time is because I spent the last 10 years being a broadcaster and a writer, and before that was a practicing, you know, working geneticist in the lab. And as a broadcaster, you know, doing your job, I found myself having very different conversations with the various publics that tune in and read about science than the ones I was having with my colleagues at University College London, where I still mm-hmm. have a post. And it struck me that there was things that we could talk about with colleagues, with other geneticists, which were non-controversial, you know, just stuff that is accepted to be correct according to the science that we do. Often would be radically different, like 180 degrees out from the types of conversations I was having with people in the public. And so my thesis goes like this. Genetics is merely the formal study of sex and inheritance and families, right? And it's a science which is only really 100 years old in any sort of serious form, and in any sophisticated form, sort of only, you know, 20 or 30 years old. But it turns out that people have been having sex and having families and talking about inheritance for much longer than that. So in terms of the difference in those stories, I feel like geneticists are sometimes contending with, you know, 10,000 years worth of cultural understanding of inheritance that is in many ways is being refuted only in the last 10 years, only since the Human Genome Project. So, you know, here's a sort of trivial example. A couple of years ago over here, there was a very high profile case of a young blonde-haired girl being kidnapped, and she was never found. And it was a great tragedy and a very big story here that was ongoing. And after that, as often happens in the newspapers, there was a sort of spate of reports of children being stolen or being kidnapped. And one of them came up in the press. A child with blonde hair was spotted with a group of dark-skinned Roma gypsies, so Romani, so people who we sometimes call gypsies over here in Europe, but generally they're more correctly referred to as the Roma. And the press went absolutely bonkers for this, saying, you know, why is this blonde girl aged, I don't know, you know, younger than 10, they referred to her as a blonde angel. Why is she with these swarthy, dark-skinned traveling people? It, you know, the insinuation being that that they had kidnapped her. Now, I was looking at this story and thinking, well, you know, forget the politics of it. Just let's look at the genetics of this. And I asked a bunch of colleagues that, you know, are you surprised by this? And one of my friends who works at Stanford, a geneticist, he said, I'm surprised that anyone didn't think that a blonde-haired child would be more commonly found in that family than in the rest of the population, because blonde hair and blue eyes is a recessive condition and is more likely to arise in inbred in families where they have endogamy. So culturally they tend to breed with close relatives, and that was my reasoning for it as well. I was like, well, you know, this is nuts. You're more likely to see blonde-haired children in that group than outside of it. And so it struck me that, you know, the way people were thinking about genetics and the way people were thinking about inheritance of characteristics was, in that example and many others, completely counter to what we think is not, you know, sort of unsurprising. So stuff within genetics as being, well, of course, we know this is how it works. But out amongst many publics or many people were thinking something completely opposite. So in that sense, that's why I think that, you know, we're not well tuned to understanding the complexities of inheritance in the way that science has described in the last few years.
Because we think of it in terms of cultural heritage type things, and you're the ones looking at the genes saying, nope, of course that could happen.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, here's another example, which is to do with sort of broad sweeps of migration and families and genealogy. Genealogy is now the number one hobby in the United States, and it's second only to gardening in the UK. I don't know what that says about the British. There are programs, very successful programs on the BBC, on television here, and I know there are similar ones in the States where people get celebrities to trace their ancestry and they look for interesting people in their past.
Oh, sure.
And
yeah.
If you can name someone, if you can name someone famous in your ancestry, or, you know, a group of people who are interesting, then that's kudos. That's kudos for genealogy enthusiasts. I get like 10 emails a week asking me or telling me that their ancestry is Viking. And the thing is, when we work out the maths on this, and now when we work out the genetics on how ancestry and how families actually work, the truth of the matter is that if you are pale-skinned and you are broadly of European descent, then you definitely have Viking ancestry, unequivocally, in the same way that you also have Saracen ancestry and Anglo-Saxon ancestry and Jewish ancestry and Muslim ancestry, because we're dealing with the fact that, well, two things which sound counterintuitive, or sounds counter to each other. One is that there are more people alive today than at any other point in history. And the second thing is that if you go back through time, back through the generations, the number of ancestors that you have doubles every generation back. You have two parents, four grandparents, and so on. Now, those two things look as though they should be in conflict with each other, because as you go back through time, your number of ancestors goes up. But as we progress through time, the number of people alive also goes up. The answer is kind of obvious, really. It's that you have to cram the number of people in your ancestral family tree into the number of people that are alive at that time. And what that means is that there are some positions on your family tree that are occupied by the same person multiple times. Basically, what I'm saying is, over a long enough time period, humans are very inbred. Now, then you get back to this point in time, we call it the ISA point, where everyone alive who has descendants alive today is the ancestor of everyone alive today. I know it's a bit early on the West Coast to be dealing with this. But what it means, basically, and it, when it comes out for Europe, is the 10th century. So if you're alive in the 10th century and you have descendants who are alive today, then you are the ancestor of everyone in Europe alive today. And that means that everyone in Europe is descended from Vikings, because the Vikings come before that time. So that's a sort of cultural identity thing, which is of trivial but fun importance to people. You know, it's one of the arguments I make in the book as well is about how misunderstanding of genetics has become very, very closely entwined with identity politics.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
For the most part, it's trivial. You know, it's cool finding out you're descended from Vikings. Well, you know, you don't have to spend £100 to $100 to do that anymore. You can just know it because I'm telling you it's true.
Adam Rutherford is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, geneticist, teacher at University College London, and broadcaster of science over many years at BBC4. And his recent book is called The Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, A Human Story Retold Through Our Genes. You can help us tell the story, and your questions and comments are welcome at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I love where the part where you say the human story is a story of agriculture, disease, kings and queens, plague, and plenty of deviant sex, and that's just part of the list. But genetically, you say, it's a pathway of creeps, not jerks. Which is a great turn of a phrase, meaning what?
Well, I pinched that off the famous evolutionary biologist called Stephen Jay Gould, who many of your listeners will have heard of and read the books of. It was a famous academic argument in the 70s and 80s, largely between Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Dawkins, but also, you know, more broadly in the field of evolutionary biology. And it was really the question of whether evolution progressed in a sort of steady, organisms just change steadily over time in response to the changing environment. That was called phyletic gradualism, is a technical term for it. Or whether it sort of went along without really changing very much, and then something major would happen, an earthquake would go off, or a volcano would go off, or something dramatic would happen, and there'd be a sudden shift in evolutionary pressures, and you'd have a sudden change in evolutionary adaptation. So the joke became the first one, phyletic gradualism, became creeping, and the other one, which is called punctuated equilibrium, became known as jerking. Right, so you got creeps and jerks, and it was a big hoo-ha at the time. And the truth is, often when you have these types of fights in science, the answer is, well, you know, it's a bit of both.
Creeps and jerks through our history. You do stick to the genus Homo in the book. Obviously, we are Homo sapiens. Some variations within there. The variations include Homo floresiensis, which, as you point out, this is one of those species it's really hard to get a DNA sample from. These are the so-called hobbits of the South Pacific.
Yeah, what a great story that was a few years ago. So the discovery of, I think it was 9 individuals, all about 4 feet tall, with large feet, in a cave in the Indonesian island of Flores. And they were incredibly recent. When they were discovered, they were thought to be possibly as recent as 12,000 years ago. So, you know, that's just before the onset of widespread agriculture and Homo sapiens all around the world. But they were peculiar. They were very peculiar species of humans. So they were named Homo floresiensis. It was decided that they qualified to be within the genus Homo. We think they were, you know, distant cousins of ours rather than on our own ancestral family tree. We think that they were very small, because you have a weird phenomenon in evolutionary biology where populations that exist on small islands are often subject to becoming very small, so dwarfism, or very large, so gigantism. So it's to do with just being isolated. So you've got these 4-foot-high sort of primitive humans, but you've also giant rats the size of, dogs, and hippos the size of dogs as well. So those are the types of things that these hobbits were feeding off. It was an amazing study, an amazing discovery. The problem was the bones weren't fossilized, right? So when they were discovered in this wet cave system, they were kind of like tissue paper. So they reconstructed the skulls and the bones, and you can see them in museums all over the world now as reproductions. But they were wet, and most of the samples are now effectively destroyed. So we never managed to get, the scientists never managed to get DNA out of any of them yet. You know, people have still got their fingers crossed about this, but we can't place them on the family tree using genetics because we didn't get their DNA.
So with the Homo floresiensis, were they small because of limits to the resources on the island, or just because that is what the genetic result of the inbreeding of a small population became?
We don't think it was to do with inbreeding. There was a lot of argument at the time about whether they were diseased humans. They were small because they were actually suffering from some disorder that was bred into them. We don't think that's true. Their morphology is too consistent amongst the specimens. So we think it's more likely to be island dwarfism, where, you know, a small population gets isolated on a particular island, and as a result of changing evolutionary pressures, they have no reason to be big, and being small is maybe more efficient in terms of just survival.
Huh.
So
they work for them. Okay, Adam. Yeah, back to talk more with Adam Rutherford about a brief history of everyone who ever lived on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. And we're just zipping through the human story here in this hour of the Jefferson Exchange with Adam Rutherford, geneticist, teacher, author, and broadcaster. And author, of course, is of the recent book, A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, The Human Story Retold Through Our Genes, a chance to look at how our information about the human genome, our knowledge has increased so much in recent years. We understand a lot more about human movements, and we also understand the many things that we don't know. Rumsfeldian, he points out at one point in the book, the known unknowns, things like that. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's start with a question from Connie in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, gentlemen. Hi. Everybody loves this topic, I'm sure. I just have sort of a broad question. Obviously, for hundreds of thousands of years, we have either been cloistered in tribal or clan or even racial or other groups where we inbred, and then for whatever reason, whether it's war or larger tribes or something, we get a massive introduction of new genetic material, or we're moving. So it seems like we've been going back and forth like a tidal pool of cloistering and inbreeding, and then, for whatever reason, this injection of all kinds of new DNA, and then proceeding onward. And I wondered how that affects our development over the centuries.
Great question, and well noted in the book as well, Connie. Thanks.
Yeah, hi, Connie. Yeah, it is a great question. In fact, it's one of the central questions of trying to redraw the migration of humans over the Earth from, you know, starting in Africa. We were primarily an African species 100,000 years ago, and then we trace using both bones and more recently genetics, we can trace the migration of humans across the Earth. We are quite tribal. We do tend to move in groups, and nowadays even more so where we have sort of artificial boundaries like passports and countries and things like that. The thing is that we're much more fluid than I think we give ourselves credit for. And I mean that both in movement and in reproduction, so who we mate with historically. And so, you know, that notion, I was talking about it a bit to Jeff a minute ago, this idea of the isopoint for humans. For the global population of humans, the isopoint is only 3,500 years ago. So that means that in about the 14th century BC, everyone who is alive in the 14th century BC is the ancestor of everyone alive on Earth today. And it's kind of baffling, but it's, without meaning to get too crude, the first chapter, the first chapter's heading, which I'll leave Jeff to say, but basically humans are really good at two things. We're really good at moving, and we're really good at having sex. And so, as a result of that, we've spread our genes much further than just having sort of over generational time. This means, and over centuries, rather than over, you know, short periods of time. We are tribal, but not over any sort of long time period.
And just to sound more dignified, I'll pronounce the word the way you do in England. Horny and mobile is that first chapter in the book. So there we go. Story of the human race. Tim in Eureka sent in an email, and he says, this may come out of left field for your speaker, but I see the Noah story in the latest DNA discoveries with a bottleneck at one point and then three sons. Also, on a metaphorical level, our genome could be the Ark with a culmination of evolutionary pairs. Heresy for the ivory tower, I know, but does your speaker see any correlation with this line of history or legend and genetic research, i.e. human migration? That from Tim in Eureka.
Well, metaphorically, yes. Actually, and historically, no. So what I mean by that is that I mentioned in answering Connie's question that we are an African species and we were Homo sapiens is evolved in Africa before spreading around the rest of the world. A relatively small group of people left Africa and made the founding population for everyone else in the world outside of Africa. That's the sort of broad picture. And that means something quite interesting in terms of when we talk about race, which is that there is more genetic diversity within Africa than there is in the rest of the world put together. So what that means is that the founding population for the rest of the world was a very limited gene pool compared to the people who remained in Africa and are largely of recent African descent. The way we talk about this is you say, well, if you take someone from, I don't know, Ethiopia, and you take someone from South Africa, and you compare their genomes to each other, their genomes will be more different to each other than either one of them will be to anyone else on the rest of the planet. So there are more differences within Africa between people, despite the fact that their skin color might be quite similar. But there are overall, when you look at the whole genome, there are more differences within Africa than compared to the rest of the world. So in that sense, yeah, we do have founding populations and we have limited gene pools for many populations around the world. But the timescale is not in line with the Judeo-Christian version. You know, we're talking like 80 to 100,000 years ago.
All right, so a bit longer ago than the Bible would indicate. We talked about blue-eyed blondes in the context of a blue-eyed blonde girl being part of a Roma family in Europe, and the fact is that yes, it's recessive, and when you have a fairly tightly confined gene pool, you're going to have more recessive traits show up, which explains blue-eyed blondes. You also get into redheads in the same passage of the book. So, what is the story about redheads potentially being doomed?
Well, it turned out to be a PR stunt, but by the time I woke up one morning, I'd had 77 emails from journalists and friends and various people around the world saying, is this true? Are redheads going extinct? And, you know, whilst I wiped the sleep from my eyes, I was thinking, oh, what is this? And it was a PR stunt by one of the consumer genetic companies based in the UK, and it's now gone bust, but was selling a genetic test to show whether you carried a gene for having red hair. Redheadedness is a recessive trait, so you have to have two copies of the redheaded gene in order to have red hair itself. Now, it turns out I am a carrier. I don't have any obvious redheads in my family, but I have one copy of the gene. I have black hair. Well, actually, it's kind of graying, to be honest. I remember that day I asked my students, can you think of a way in which redheads would go extinct? And they were brilliant, because within about 5 minutes they came up with two reasons, only two. And the first was that everyone goes extinct, so humans go extinct, which, yeah, I couldn't argue with that. Good creative genocide there from my students. And the second was that everyone with red hair and everyone who was a carrier of the redhead gene would suddenly, for some reason, stop having sex. Now, even though red hair is the least common hair color on Earth, globally it's about 2 or 3%. In Scotland, it's as high as 10. It's also high in areas of North America due to migration from Scotland and Northern Europe. But, you know, still 4% of the global population is what? Quickly do the maths in my head. Well, it's
times,
tens of millions.
Yeah, 228 million? 208
million? I'll take your word for it. That's a lot of people to suddenly decide that they're not going to reproduce. So as ever, it's one of those situations where, you know, it was a publicity stunt. It was a headline that the newspapers thought was really sexy. And it's left to the more scientifically minded to pick up the pieces.
Indeed. And well, but this gets back to the whole issue, though, of the genetic testing companies and what people in genetics proper think about the more amateur form of this, the spit kits that people can swab their cheeks and send in and get a report. I mean, first of all, what are they getting in the reports? And second of all, what's the scientific view of those?
Yeah, that's a great question. I take a moderately dim view of some of these tests. The data itself is okay. You know, it's basic genetic data. We've got so good at doing at sampling and reading people's DNA that these companies are all over the world, and it's cheap. Yeah, for $100 or so.
Mm-hmm.
We said earlier, you know, genealogy is the number one hobby for Americans. And so this is now part of the mix. You send off and get some genetic information about your family history. The thing is, we have to be really specifically clear about what the results actually show. And they don't show where your genes, where your DNA originated in history. And the reason they don't show that is because there is no scientific method of doing that. And that is not a thing that exists. What they show is where your genes or where genes similar to your own are found on Earth today in living people. And, you know, I make absurd examples in the book to demonstrate the where the limitations of this science are. So, you know, I'm half Indian. My mother was Indian. My father is English. And so when I got one of my tests back, half of my DNA is from, you know, the northwest of the UK and Western Europe and Scandinavia, and half of my DNA is most closely associated with the subcontinent, with India. You know, big surprise there.
Right.
You could, right? Imagine if this didn't happen, but imagine if the entire population of India moved to India in January 1975, when I was born, right? The map would be exactly the same. You know, my genetic data would be exactly the same if that had happened.
That's what I was going to ask you. So if they had moved from Australia the week before, I mean, then the information, and they'd been there for thousands of years, that would not be reflected.
Exactly. And so, you know, we know this because people move around the world all the time, and migration is a constant presence in human populations and has been for thousands of years, more so ever now than ever before. So, of course, you know, if you immigrated to the States in the middle of the 20th century, you're not going to have indigenous DNA. You're not going to have DNA that is very similar to DNA from you know, tribal populations who've been there for 20,000 years. It's kind of obvious. If you moved from Western Europe, you're going to have DNA which most closely resembles those from Western Europe. So DNA is really good at identifying very close family relationships. It's amazing for, you know, for long lost cousins or in paternity suits. Or at the moment, we're going through a really interesting phase because the people who are interested in genealogy tend to be a little bit older, and possibly they may have retired. We're just getting to the point where people who have retired may have been conceived in the 1940s and the late 40s. And so at least here in the UK, there are tons of stories now about war babies, about people who were adopted or didn't know who their father was, often because they were American soldiers who were stationed over in the UK. So DNA is really good at identifying immediate family members. It's not so good at analyzing sort of deep migration over historical time. It's also very good at identifying sort of really broad migration of humans across the globe over hundreds of thousands of years. It's just that middle period which it's a bit iffy about.
So you say that we swing between the extremes of genetic determinism and genetic denialism. How do you think we should be thinking about genetics?
Well, it's complex. I mean, that is how I think about it. That's not my answer to your question. I think that people often turn to science or statistics as a sort of comfort blanket for, you know, simple answers. They're looking for simple answers to complex problems. And humans are complex and messy. And, you know, we're a terrible experimental organism because we don't behave like rats in cages or fruit flies, so beloved of geneticists. We live lives, and we live complex lives, and we remarry and adopt children, and we have wars, and you know, and so on. We also are the product of both our genes and our environment. And it doesn't, when we say environment, you know, that whole nature and nurture thing.
Right.
Those are two things which are in concert with each other. They're not versus each other. There is no conflict between nature, which is your DNA, and nurture, which is everything that is not your DNA. And that includes the orientation of a fetus inside its mother's womb, which can have an effect on the child's development. It goes from things like that right up to, you know, which school you went to, whether your parents hugged you or not, or read to you, and all those sorts of things as well. So the sense that we would be able to find simple answers to the complex questions of, you know, what we are and how we came to be was, I think, pretty misplaced. And what's turned out is that it is much more complicated than I think anyone anticipated.
And it starts at an amazing level. I mean, you take us right back to egg and sperm and talk about how the orientation of where head and tail will turn up depend on where the sperm enters the egg. So we go from all ends of the, if you pardon the expression, of the equation here in the book. It's called A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, The Human Story Retold Through Our Genes. It's the work of Adam Rutherford. Thanks so much for joining us today, Adam.
Thanks, Jeff. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Pleasure. Take care.